Thank you, choir. Absolutely beautiful. I said to the early service, I sometimes am tempted to believe I may be right, that a cappella voices are the highest form of Christian praise. It's really beautiful. I'm going to take just a moment to do a brief advertisement. We've been working on this for a long time. You've got this in your bulletin. Tonight at 5 o'clock, I'm going to do a presentation. I'm going to try to do it in 30 minutes with 15 minutes for Q&A. 30 minutes, the title of my presentation is How to Think About God. And I'm going to share with you some tools, primarily in the form of questions, that will help guide you in your faith journey. How can you think about God? Now, some of you might be atheists or closet agnostics. Some of you might be confessing Christians, but you've got lots of doubts. Most of us are confessing Christians, but we're just a little bit fuzzy about everything. Maybe there are a few of us that have vital lives of faith. We're going to be addressing all of those groups tonight and saying this is a way in which you can think about God that will help move you further down in your spiritual journey, whichever way you decide to go. So it's a kind of a summary of all things I've been thinking over the last few years. I really do hope you'll be there. I think it'll be interesting. We've got really good cookies. If you don't like my presentation, there are really good cookies and there's some swag. Kathy Sweeney's got some swag. When I'm through, she's going to unveil a program that I hope a lot of you will call The Journey, that I hope a lot of you will consider participating in. It is designed to help you move you further down into a richer, more vital, spiritual faith journey. Now today, we're finishing up this series on Young Jesus, the early years. All of these sermons have been in the second chapter of Luke, beginning with verse 21 through, I think it's verse 53. We've talked about this has proved to be much richer than I thought it would be. Four different stories compacted in that 30 verses or so. And today we're going to read the final one about Jesus going to the temple. Let me just give you a bit of background. Many of you have been to Jerusalem and to Nazareth. So there's a little distance between Jerusalem and Nazareth, and that's where they were going when they went to the temple. This is a story that some of you are familiar with, beginning with verse 41. Now every year his parents went to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. And when Jesus was 12 years old, they went up as usual for the festival. When the festival was ended and they started to return to Jerusalem, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but his parents did not know it. Now, this next verse is going to tell us about how they were traveling in a group, if you can figure this out. Friends, family, a bunch of people traveling from Nazareth in a group on the road. Everybody's looking after everybody else's kids. You don't worry about it too much. Assuming that he was in the group of travelers, they went a full day's journey back from Jerusalem. Then they started to look for him among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem to search for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Here's Jesus listening and asking questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and at his answers. We'll see, how many of you had this experience when your kid ran away from you at the State Fair of Texas? When his parents saw him, they were astonished. And you know, you're relieved and scared both. And his mother said to him, "Child, why have you treated us like this? Look, your father and I have been searching for you in great anxiety." And he said to them, "Why were you searching for me? Did you not know that I would be in my Father's house?" This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Let me ask you a hypothetical question. What would you do if your life was changed rather dramatically and you were convinced that God had had a hand in it? It seems to me that that really is the theme of the second chapter of Luke, beginning with verse 21. The backstory is a story that you know quite well. These two young people, maybe Joseph was in his 20s or early 30s, Mary nothing but a teenager, maybe 14, 15 years old, growing up in this small town of Nazareth. If you grew up in Muleshoe, Texas, you could think maybe like your hometown, little town in West Texas. And all of a sudden they have what could be called extraordinary, perhaps even ecstatic experiences. God comes to them in the form of angels and alerts them to the fact that they're going to have a baby way before any time they had planned. But the baby would belong to God. That in fact, the baby would be the child of God. So that's the backstory. And we see here, beginning in verse 21 that we dealt with 3 weeks ago, the answer that these two young parents have. What do you do when you believe that your life has been radically changed and God had a hand in it? The first thing they did, this is a bit of a review, is that they made a commitment to live a disciplined life guided by the principles and traditions of their faith. Secondly, as a response to that, the first thing that they did, the first place they went with their child, they took him to the temple. They took him to the temple for the rituals and the rites, for the circumcision and the blessing. Last week, we talked about how they brought him back home. And when they brought him back home, they raised him. We are told by Luke that he grew in stature and in wisdom and in favor with God. And so they obviously decided to raise Jesus and to teach him more than just his ABCs, more than just, you know, the multiplication tables. They decided to teach him about God, about the wisdom that is found in their faith tradition. And then this week, they go back to the temple. And Jesus claims it as his own. Didn't you know that I would be here in my Father's house? And so you see the progression here. Mary and Joseph, they're convinced that what has happened to them is comes from God. And so immediately they take Jesus to the temple. And when they get to the temple immediately embraces Jesus. And the second Sunday we saw Simeon raising Jesus up, the baby Jesus, the infant, and said, "This is not only a child of God, but this is the Messiah. I can now die in peace." And the prophetess Anna making the same kind of affirmation about him. So they take him to the temple. The temple embraces him. They take him back home. He is raised by the traditions within the temple. And today, now Jesus goes back to the temple and Jesus embraces the temple. "This is my Father's house." Home, temple, and synagogue, Dr. Fred Craddock, the great New Testament professor and preacher, home, temple, and synagogue formed who Jesus was as a young man. So today there's a couple of interesting questions, I think, for us to deal with. This is one, I don't know whether you think this way when you read this passage, but it occurred to me. Are we to believe that Jesus really did need to go to the temple in order to learn about God? I mean, that's kind of an interesting question, isn't it? Jesus was the Son of God. God was the theological word. God was incarnate in Jesus. God was in Jesus's flesh. Jesus was God. And so did Jesus really need to go to the temple in order to learn about God? Well, guess what? The answer is yes. When you read this passage, the answer is clearly yes. Jesus goes to the temple because he thought this was his spiritual home in some ways. And we are told that he entered into dialogue with the great teachers of Judaism in the temple. He was asking them questions and they were asking him questions. And there was this dialogue going back and forth. And so his answers amazed them. He was there to learn about God. He was there to learn about his faith. And I would go so far as to say that he was there because he understood that the practice of faith is partly social in nature. It's not something that we do on our own. We can be spiritual, we can believe in God on our own, but the practice of faith, this is all about how Mary and Joseph decided to practice their faith. The practice of faith is not something that is done in a solitary way. How do we know that? We see it in the very beginning of the Bible. We can flip back there to the Bible, the 12th chapter of Genesis, and we see Abraham and Sarah out there. They're doing fine out there by themselves in his ancestral home. But God comes to them and says, look, it's not just about you. It's about generations yet to be born. I need you to get up and leave this place because there's work to be done. And then we can look there. It's the third chapter of Exodus. We can look there, the story of Moses, maybe even a better example. Moses is camped out there on the plains of Midian, and he has a great life. He's taking care of the sheep of his father-in-law, Jethro. He believes in God. It's a pastoral life, serene in almost every way. And he comes upon this burning bush, and he realizes this is God. He takes off his shoes. He falls to his knees of the burning bush. And he thinks this is a kind of ecstatic experience. He knows that God is in this place, and he wants to stay. And God says, guess what? That's not the reason I'm here. I'm not here because I need you to stay here. I'm here because I need you to go and return to the Jewish community from which you came, because you cannot practice your faith alone. That, whether you like it or not, that really is the story of faith as we see it in the Bible, both Old and New Testaments. Did Jesus really need to go to the temple? Yes, he did. Because we practice our faith with others, loving God, loving others. A number of years ago, we had a dessert party in our home. I'll never forget. We used to do this. We would have dessert parties. When we were smaller, we would have dessert parties for all of our new members in our home. I think we'd do it once every other month or something. In this particular party, we had a pretty good group there, maybe 24, 25, 26 people. And we were sitting in our living room. People were sitting around on chairs and the couches and so forth. And we always did it the same way. We would have some dessert. People would mill around. Then they would take a seat. And we would start on one side or the other. And I would ask people to go around, introduce yourselves, tell us where you came from. Those kind of questions are always interesting to me. And then I would always ask people to say, now, what brought you to Christ Church? And on this particular evening, we got about halfway around the group, and we came to this young woman in her 30s, a single mother, very sophisticated, very bright, very articulate. And she told us about where she grew up, and about she had a really interesting job. And then we were about to go to the next person. She turned to the next person. I said, well, wait a minute. Tell us, what brought you to Christ Church? And she said, my six-year-old daughter came to me a few weeks ago. And she said, Mama, how will I ever learn about God if you don't take me to church? There was a moment of powerful silence in my living room, just as there is now. How will I ever learn about God if you don't take me to church? My friend Lisa Miller, author of The Spiritual Child, she's a teacher at Columbia's Teachers College in New York City. Her best-selling book, The Spiritual Child, she won't be surprised by that question. She says that children are naturally, she says it's in their genes, naturally spiritually curious. Whether they're Jewish, whether they're Muslim, Christian, it doesn't make any difference. That children always want to know about God. And she says we are missing extraordinary opportunities with our children if we're not providing an opportunity for them to be spiritually nurtured and nourished, a place where they can answer, where they can ask questions and perhaps dialogue. And her research is extremely compelling. We had her here a few years ago. The different outcomes between children who have been raised in a spiritual community, whether the synagogue or the church, doesn't make any difference. The difference in the outcomes, children who've been raised in the church and children who have not been nurtured spiritually. Mama, how will I know about God? How will I learn about God if you don't take me to church? I have to tell you that that question haunts me. It has for a long time. If I were able to do this, I would put that question in big bold letters on a big banner and fly it behind Cessna airplanes at 7:45 every morning around every elementary school in North Dallas. I would want every parent to confront that question. I don't say this in a mean way at all. Most of our parents are good parents. Most of our parents believe in God. Most of our parents are trying to teach their children about God. It's just that you can't really do it fully, completely, comprehensively without the faith community gathered. How will I learn about God? This child understood it. How will I learn about God if you don't take me to the church? Increasingly, we are living our lives in ways that are extraordinarily isolated. We live in little tiny bubbles. Some of that is caused by technology in our phones. I talked about that last week. I won't launch into that again. But we are living isolated lives. And to a great extent, the isolation in which we are living is destroying the fabric of our society. I want to share some research with you. Some of you may be familiar with this, but to a great extent, this is research that every sociologist in America knows about, but to a great extent, it has not really filtered down to the average person. A lot of you will be familiar with this book. In 2001, a PhD sociologist at Harvard wrote a book called Bowling Alone. It was some research that he had been working on. Really, nobody knew about it then. Since then, over the last 18 years, tons of work has been done about this. Nobody debates this research. I went to Amazon I couldn't find my book. I went to Amazon to refresh my memory on when the book came out, 2001. And I started reading the summary of the book from Amazon. I thought, I can't say it any better, so I don't read to you very often. I'm just going to read this to you. It's short, but it's powerful. His metaphor was based upon the fact that fewer people bowl in bowling leagues in America today. He argued that civil society was breaking down as Americans became more disconnected. Listen to these words. Civil society. See if this is familiar to you. See if this makes sense to you in terms of what's going on in America today. Civil society is breaking down as Americans become more disconnected from their families, their neighbors, communities, and the republic itself. The organizations that give life to democracy are fraying. Bowling became his driving metaphor. This is the research. Years ago, he wrote, thousands of people belong to bowling leagues. Today, just as many people bowl, but they're more likely to bowl alone in their little bubble. Television, two-career families, suburban sprawl, generational changes in values, and now we know technology and social media. These and other changes in American society have meant that fewer and fewer of us find that the League of Women Voters or the United Way or the Shriners or the Monthly Bridge Club or even a Sunday picnic with friends, or I will say even church or Sunday school, fits into the way we have come to live. Our growing social capital deficit threatens educational performance, safe neighborhoods, equitable tax collection, democratic responsiveness, everyday honesty, and even our health and happiness. There's no secret about this. I can give you a list of books that have come after that confirms this research. We are coming apart in America because we are no longer woven together by the fabrics of the institutions that once held us together, including the church. We live in our bubbles. A few years ago, my wife said to me, Don, let's take a walk. She liked to walk around the neighborhood. I didn't much do it. I have other ways of working out. So I said, I'll take a walk with you. So we start walking around the neighborhood. This couple passes us on the sidewalk, and they spoke to us. And Bobby spoke to them. She obviously knew them, and we kept walking along. I said, Bobby, who was that? She said, Don, those are our neighbors. They're our neighbors. I mean, I was exhibit number one. I didn't know our neighbors. So you understand, when I talk about flying a banner around every school in Plano, saying, well, why don't you bring your child to Sunday school? I don't care whether it's the Baptist church, the Methodist church, the synagogue, the mosque. I mean, I obviously have an agenda there. Some of you are thinking, well, of course, he's a preacher. This is a church. This is his job. He wants to get all those kids into the church, into Sunday school. You bet I do. Of course I do. But it is more than that. The churches, the synagogues, you can go on, the bridge clubs, you name it, the institutions that bring us together, help us learn how to talk to one another, civil conversation, shared values, the loss of trust in our institutions is destroying who we are. I may be old-fashioned, I don't know. All I know is that it's right there in the second chapter of Luke. When Joseph and Mary realized that this child had come to them as a gift from God, they said, oh gosh, our lives are going to radically change. What are we going to do now? They made the commitment to practice their faith. And they understood that the practice of faith is something we do with others. With others. This is an important moment in the life of America. I happen to believe that the bubbles in which we are living, the loss of institutional life, I happen to believe that this is a blip on the radar screen. That 20 or 30 years from now, we'll look back and we'll say this was just a little phase that we went through in America. We'll see the growth in healthy institutional life again. But this much I know, that if it happens, it will be led by the church. By the church, the one institution, the one organization in America that is committed to love. That is committed to love. The one institution whose mission is defined by love. In this church, we say, loving God and serving neighbor. So maybe we should end the way we began. If you looked at your own life and you say, you know, my life is different somehow. I know that my life is different, and I'm pretty sure that God had a hand in it. What would you do?